Answer. No, ma'am. There are no flights out because of the troubles. She wrote every hour. Only flights coming in. Well, when are they going to start up again? I need to get to Congo urgently. The two members of staff exchanged a silent look. No flights to Congo, they repeated. She hadn't come this far for blank looks and refusals. I cannot give up on him now. Outside, the man continued up and down the runway with his threadbare broom. It was then that she saw a white man walking briskly through the terminal with the upright posture of the civil service, carrying a leather folder. Sweat had coloured a deep triangle on the back of his cream linen jacket. He saw her as she saw him. He changed direction and strode towards her.
Mrs. Ramsay, he held out a hand, I'm Alexander Frobisher from the consulate. Where are your children?
No, my name is Jennifer Sterling. He closed his mouth and seemed to be trying to gauge whether she had made a mistake. His face was puffy, perhaps adding years to his true age. I do need your help, Mr. Frobisher, she continued. I have to get to Congo. Do you know if there's a train I can catch? I'm told there are no flights. Actually, nobody will tell me very much at all. She was conscious that her own face was glowing with heat, that her hair had already started to come down. When he spoke, it was as if he was trying to explain something to the unhinged.
Mrs.
Sterling.
Mrs. Sterling, nobody is going into Congo. Don't you know this?
Yes, I do know there's been some trouble there, but I have to find someone, a journalist, who came out perhaps 2 weeks ago. It's terrifically important. His name is...
Madam, there are no journalists left in Congo.
He removed his glasses and steered her to the window.
Do you have any idea of what has happened?
A little. Well, no. I've been travelling from England. I had to take a rather tortuous route.
The war has now dragged in the US as well as our and other governments. Until 3 days ago, we were in crisis, with 350 white hostages, including women and children, facing execution by the Simba rebels. We have Belgian troops fighting it out with them in the streets of Stanleyville. Up to 100 civilians are already reported dead.
She barely heard him. But I can pay, and I'll pay whatever it takes I have to get there.
He took her arm. Mrs. Sterling, I'm telling you that you will not make it to Congo. There are no trains, no flights, no roads in. The troops were airlifted. Even if there was transport, I could not sanction a British citizen, a British woman, entering a war zone.
He scribbled in his notebook.
I'll find you somewhere to wait and help you book your return flight home. Africa is no place for a white woman on her own.
He sighed wearily, as she had just doubled his burden. Jennifer was thinking. How many are dead?
We don't know.
Have you their names?
I only have the most rudimentary list at the moment. It's far from comprehensive.
Please. Her heart had almost stopped. Please, let me see. I need to know if he's... He pulled a tattered piece of typed paper from his folder. She scanned it. Her eyes so tired that the names, in alphabetical order, blurred. Harper, Hambro, O'Keefe, Lewis. His was not there. His was not there. She glanced up at Frobisher. Do you have the names of those taken hostage?
Mrs. Sterling, we have no idea how many British citizens were even in the city. Look.
He produced another piece of paper and handed it to her, swatting with his free hand at a mosquito that had landed on the back of his neck.
This is the latest communique sent to Lord Walston.
She started to read, phrases leaping out at her. 5,000 dead in Stanleyville alone. We believe that there remain in rebel-held territory 27 United Kingdom citizens. We can give no indication as to when the areas where British subjects are, even if we knew them with any degree of exactness, will be reached.
There are Belgian and US troops in the city. They're taking back Stanleyville. and we have a Beverly aircraft standing by to rescue those who want to be rescued.
How can I make sure that he's on it?
He scratched his head.
You can't. Some people don't seem to want to be rescued. Some prefer to stay in Congo. They may have their reasons.
She thought suddenly of the fat news editor.
Who knows? Perhaps he wanted to get away. If your friend wants to get out, he will get out, he said.
He wiped his face with a handkerchief.
If he wants to stay, it's perfectly possible that he'll disappear. Easily done in Congo.
She was about to speak, but was cut off by a low murmur that rippled through the airport. As, through the arrival gate, a family emerged. First came two small children, mute, with bandaged arms, heads, their faces prematurely aged. A blonde woman clutching a baby was wild-eyed, her hair unwashed, and her face etched with strain. At the sight of them, a much older woman broke free of her husband's restraining arm and burst through the barrier, wailing, and pulled them to her. The family barely stirred. Then the young mother, crumpling to her knees, began to cry, her mouth a great O of pain, her head sagging onto the older woman's plump shoulder. Frobisher stuffed his papers back into his folder.
The Ramses. Excuse me, I must look after them.
Were they there? She said, watching the grandfather hoist the little girl onto his shoulders. At the massacre. The children's faces, immobilized by some unknown shock, had turned her blood to iced water.
He gave her a firm look. Mrs. Sterling, please, you must go now. There's an East African Airways flight out this evening. Unless you have well-connected friends in this city, I cannot urge you more strongly to be on it.
It took her 2 days to get home, and from that point her new life began. Yvonne was true to her word. She did not contact her again, and on the one occasion Jennifer bumped into Violet, the other woman was so plainly filled with discomfort that it seemed unfair to pursue her. She minded less than she might have expected. They belonged to an old life, which she hardly recognised as her own. Most days Mrs. Cordoza came to the new flat, finding excuses to spend time with Esme, or help with a few household tasks, and Jennifer found she relied more on her former housekeeper's company than she had her old friends. One wet afternoon, while Esme slept, she told Mrs. Cordoza about Anthony. Mrs. Cordoza confided a little more about her husband. Then, with a blush, she talked about a nice man who had sent her flowers from the restaurant 2 streets along.
I wasn't going to encourage him, she said softly into her ironing, but since everything.
Lawrence communicated in notes, using Mrs. Cordoza as an emissary.
I would like to take Esme to my cousin's wedding in Winchester this coming Saturday. I will make sure she is back by 7 p.m.
They were distant, formal, measured. Occasionally Jennifer would read them and wonder that she could have been married to this man. Every week she walked to the post office on Langley Street to find out whether there was anything in the P.O. box. Every week she returned home trying not to feel flattened by the postmistress's no. She moved into the rented flat, and when Esme started school, she took an unpaid job at the local Citizens Advice Bureau, the only organisation that seemed unworried by her lack of experience. She would learn on the job, the supervisor said,
and believe me, you'll learn rather quickly.
Less than a year later, she was offered a paid position in the same office. She advised people on practical matters, such as how to manage money, how to handle rent disputes, there were too many bad landlords, how to cope with family breakdown. At first she had been exhausted by the never-ending litany of problems, the sheer wall of human misery that traipsed through the office. But gradually, as she grew more confident, she saw that she was not alone in making a mess of her life. She reassessed herself and found that she was grateful for where she was, where she had ended up, and felt a certain pride when someone returned to tell her that she had helped. 2 years later, she and Esme moved again, to the two-bedroom flat in St. John's Wood, bought with money provided by Lawrence and Jennifer's inheritance from an aunt. As the weeks became months and then years, she came to accept that Anthony O'Hare would not return. He would not answer her messages. She was overcome only once, when the newspapers reported some details of the massacre at Stanleyville's Victoria Hotel. Then she had stopped reading them altogether. She had rung the nation just once more. A secretary had answered, and when she gave her name, briefly hopeful that Anthony might, this time, happen to be there, she heard,
"Is it that Sterling woman?"
And the answer, "Isn't she the one he didn't want to speak to?" She had replaced the receiver. It was 7 years before she saw her husband again. Esme was to start at boarding school, a sprawling red brick place in Hampshire, with the shambolic air of a well-loved country house. Jennifer had taken the afternoon off work to drive her, and they had travelled in her new Mini. She was wearing a wine-coloured suit, and had half expected Lawrence to make an unpleasant comment about it. He never had liked her in that colour.
"Please don't do it in front of Esme," she willed him. "Please, let's keep this civil."
But the man sitting in the lobby was nothing like the Lawrence she remembered. In fact, at first she didn't recognise him. His skin was grey, his cheeks hollow. He seemed to have aged 20 years. "Hello, Daddy." Esme hugged him. He nodded to Jennifer, but did not stretch out a hand.
"Jennifer," he said.
"Lawrence."
She was trying to cover her shock. The meeting was brief. The headmistress, a young woman possessed of a quietly assessing gaze, made no reference to the fact that they lived at separate addresses. Perhaps more people did now, Jennifer thought. That week she had seen 4 women in the bureau who were seeking to leave their husbands. "Well, we'll do everything in our power to make sure Esme's time here is happy," Mrs. Browning said. She had kind eyes, Jennifer thought. It does help if the girls have chosen to come to boarding school, and I understand she already has friends here, so I'm sure she'll settle in quickly.
"She reads rather a lot of Enid Blyton," Jennifer said. "I suspect she thinks it's all Midnight Feast."
"Oh, we have a few of those. The tuck shop is open on Friday afternoons pretty much for that sole purpose. We tend to turn a blind eye, provided it doesn't get too lively. We like the girls to feel there are some advantages to boarding." Jennifer relaxed. Lawrence had chosen the school, and her fears seemed unfounded. The next few weeks would be hard, but she had grown used to Esme's periodic absences when she was staying with Lawrence, and she had her work to occupy her. The headmistress got to her feet and held out a hand.
"Thank you. We'll telephone, of course, if there are any problems."
As the door closed behind them, Lawrence began to cough, a harsh, hacking sound that made Jennifer's jaw clench. She made to say something, but he lifted a hand as if to tell her not to. They made their way slowly down the stairs side by side as if they were not estranged. She could have walked at twice the speed, but it seemed cruel to do so, given his laboured breathing and evident discomfort. Finally, unable to bear it, she stopped a passing girl and asked if she would mind fetching a glass of water. Within minutes, the girl returned, and Lawrence sat down heavily on a mahogany chair in the panelled corridor to sip it. Jennifer was now brave enough to let her eyes rest on him.
"Is it?"
she said.
"No."
He took a long, painful breath.
"It's the cigars, apparently. I'm well aware of the irony."
She took the seat beside him.
"You should know I've ensured that you will both be taken care of."
She glanced sideways at him, but he appeared to be thinking.
"We raised a good child," he said eventually.
Out of the window, they could see Esme chatting to 2 other girls on the lawn. As if at some unheard signal, the 3 ran across the grass, their skirts flying. "I'm sorry," she said, turning back to him, "for everything." He placed the glass at his side and hauled himself out of the chair. He stood for a minute with his back to her, focusing on the girls outside the window, then turned towards her, and without meeting her eye gave a small nod. She watched him walk stiffly out of the main door across the lawns to where his lady friend was waiting in the car, his daughter skipping beside him. She waved enthusiastically as the chauffeur-driven Daimler made its way back down the drive. 2 months later, Lawrence was dead.
I hate you, and I know you still like me, but I don't like you. I don't care what your stupid friends say. You make me touch your hands for stupid reasons. You accidentally say you hugged me. I will never, never like you again. I hate you. I hate you more than anything in this damn world. I'd rather date a spider or rat than you. You're so ugly and fat. Female to male, via email. Chapter 21. It has not stopped raining all evening. The dark grey clouds scudding across the city skyline until they're swallowed by night. The relentless downpour confines people to their homes, blanketing the street, so that all that is audible outside is the occasional swish of tyres on a wet road, or the gurgle of swollen drains, or the brisk footsteps of someone trying to get home. There are no messages on her answer phone, no winking envelopes suggesting a text message on her mobile. Her emails are confined to work, advertisements for generic Viagra, and one from her mother detailing the dog's further recovery from its hip replacement. Ellie sits cross-legged on the sofa, sipping her third glass of red wine, and rereading the letters she had photocopied before returning them. It is 4 hours since she left Jennifer Sterling's apartment, but her mind is still humming. She sees the unknown boot, reckless and heartbroken, in Congo at a time when white Europeans were being slain. I read the reports of the murders of a whole hotel of victims in Stanleyville, Jennifer had said, and I cried with fear. She pictures her walking to the post office week after week on a vain quest for a letter that never arrives. A tear plops onto her sleeve, and she sniffs as she wipes it away. Theirs, she thinks, was a love affair that meant something. He was a man who cracked himself open in front of the woman he loved. He sought to understand her and tried to protect her, even from herself. When he couldn't have her, he removed himself to the other side of the world and quite likely sacrificed himself. And she mourned him for 40 years. What did Ellie have? Great sex, perhaps once every 10 days, and a host of non-committal emails. She is 32 years old. Her career is sliding into the buffers. Her friends know she is on an emotional hiding to nothing, and every day it is getting harder to convince herself that this is a life she would have chosen. It's 9:15. She knows she shouldn't drink any more, but she feels angry, mournful, nihilistic. She pours another glass, cries, and rereads the last letter again. Like Jennifer, she now feels she knows these words by heart. They have an awful resonance.
Being without you, thousands of miles from you, offers no relief at all. The fact that I am no longer tormented by your proximity or presented with daily evidence of my inability to have the one thing I truly want has not healed me. It has made things worse. My future feels like a bleak, empty road.
She is half in love with this man herself. She pictures John, hears him saying the words, and alcohol makes the two blur into each other. How does one lift one's own life out of the mundane and into something epic? Surely one should be brave enough to love. She pulls her mobile phone from her bag, something dark and bold creeping under her skin. She flips it open and sends a text, her fingers clumsy on the keys. Please call. Just once. Need to hear from you. Kiss. She presses send, already knowing what a colossal error she has made. He'll be furious, or he won't respond. She's not sure which is worse. Ellie's head sinks into her hands and she weeps for the unknown boot, for Jennifer, for chances missed and a life wasted. She cries for herself, because nobody will ever love her like he loved Jennifer, and because she suspects that she is spoiling what might have been a perfectly good, if ordinary, life. She cries because she is drunk and in her flat, and there are few advantages to living on your own, except being able to sob uninhibitedly at will. She starts, when she hears the door buzzer, lifting her head and remaining immobile until it sounds again. For a brief, insane moment, she wonders if it's John, in response to her message. Suddenly galvanized, she rushes to the hall mirror, wiping frantically at the red blotches on her face, and picks up the entry phone. Hello?
Okay, smarty pants. How do you spell uninvited random caller?
She blinks. Rory.
Nope, that's not it.
She bites her lip and leans against the wall. There is a brief silence.
Are you busy? I was just passing.
He sounds merry, exuberant.
Okay, I was on the right tube line.
Come up. She hangs up the phone and splashes her face with cold water, trying not to feel disappointed, when it so obviously couldn't have been John. She hears him taking the steps two at a time, then pushing at the door she has left ajar.
I've come to drag you out for a drink.
Oh. He's eyeing the empty wine bottle, and then, for a fraction longer, her face.
Ah, too late.
She manages an unconvincing smile. Not been a great evening.
Ah.
It's fine if you want to go. He's wearing a grey scarf. It looks like cashmere. She has never owned a cashmere jumper. How has she reached the age of 32 and never owned a cashmere jumper? Actually, I'm probably not great company right now. He takes another look at the wine bottle.
Well, Howard, he says, unwinding the scarf from his neck. It's never stopped me before. How about I stick the kettle on?
He makes tea, fumbling to locate tea bags, milk, spoons in her tiny kitchen. She thinks of John, who just last week had done the same thing, and her eyes fill again with tears. Then Rory sits and places the mug in front of her. And as she drinks it, he talks uncharacteristically, volubly, about his day. The friend he has just met for a drink, who suggested some oblique route across Patagonia. The friend, he's known him since childhood, has become something of a competitive traveller.
You know the type. You say you're headed for Peru, he says, oh, forget the Machu Picchu trail. I spent 3 nights with the pygmies of Atacanta jungle. They fed me one of their relatives when we ran out of baboon meat.
Nice. She's curled up on the sofa, cradling her mug.
I love the guy, but I'm just not sure I can take 6 months of him.
That's how long you're going for?
Hopefully.
She's buffeted by another groundswell of misery. Granted, Rory isn't John, but it has been some compensation to have a man to call on for the odd evening out.
So, what's up?
He says. Oh, I had a weird day.
It's Saturday. I assumed girls like you went out gossiping over brunch and shopping for shoes.
No stereotypes there, then. I went to see Jennifer Sterling.
Who?
The letter lady. She sees his surprise. He leans forward.
Wow. She actually called you? What happened?
Suddenly she begins to cry again, tears pouring.
I'm sorry, she mutters, scrambling for tissues. I'm sorry. I don't know why I'm being so ridiculous.
She feels his hand on her shoulder, an arm around her. He smells of the pub, deodorant, clean hair, and the outside.
Hey, he's saying softly, hey, this isn't like you.
How would you know? She thinks. Nobody knows what is like me. I'm not even sure I know.
She told me everything. The whole love affair. Oh, Rory, it's heartbreaking. They loved each other so much. And they kept missing each other until he died in Africa and she never saw him again.
She's crying so hard, her words are nearly unintelligible. He's hugging her, his head dipping to catch the words.
Talking to an old lady made you this sad? A failed love affair from 40 years ago.
You had to be there. You had to hear what she said.
She tells him a little of the story and wipes her eyes.
She's so beautiful and graceful and sad.
You're beautiful and graceful and sad. Okay, perhaps not graceful.
She rests her head against his shoulder.
I never thought you were... Don't take this the wrong way, Ellie, But you surprised me. I never thought you could be that affected by those letters.
It's not just the letters,
she sniffs.
He waits. He's leaning back on the sofa now, but his hand is still resting lightly on her neck. She realizes she doesn't want it to move.
Then,
his voice is soft, inquisitive.
I'm afraid
of.
Her voice drops to a whisper.
I'm afraid nobody will ever love me like that.
Drunkenness has made her reckless. His eyes have softened. His mouth turns down a little as if in sympathy. He watches her, and she dabs feebly at her eyes. For a moment she thinks he's going to kiss her, but instead, he picks up a letter and reads aloud.
On my way home this evening, I got caught in a row that spilled out of a public house. Two men were scrapping, egged on by drunken supporters. And suddenly I was caught up in their noise and chaos, the cursing and flying bottles. A police siren sounded in the distance. Men were flying off in all directions, cars screeching across the road to avoid the fight. And all I could think about was the way the corner of your mouth curves into itself when you smile. And I had this remarkable sensation that at that precise moment you were thinking about me too. Perhaps this sounds fanciful. Perhaps you were thinking about the theatre or the crisis in the economy or whether to buy new curtains, but I realized suddenly, in the midst of that little tableau of insanity, that to have someone out there who understands you, who desires you, who sees you as a better version of yourself is the most astonishing gift. Even if we're not together, to know that, for you, I am that man, is a source of sustenance to me.
She has closed her eyes to listen to Rory's voice, softly reciting the words. She imagines how Jennifer must have felt to be loved, adored, wanted.
I'm not sure how I earned the right. I don't feel entirely confident of it even now, but even the chance to think upon your beautiful face, your smile, and know that some part of it might belong to me, is probably the single greatest thing that has happened to me in my life.
The words have stopped. She opens her eyes to find Rory's a few inches away.
For a smart woman, he says, you're remarkably dim.
He reaches out a hand, wipes away a tear with his thumb.
You don't know, she begins. You don't understand.
I think I know enough.
Before she can speak again, he kisses her. She stalls for just a moment, and that freckled hand is there again, tormenting her. Why should I feel loyalty to someone who's probably having wild holiday sex right at this very minute? And then Rory's mouth is on hers, his hands cradling her face, and she's kissing him back, her mind determinedly blank, her body simply grateful for the arms that enfold her, his lips upon hers. Blank it all out. She begs him silently, rewrite this page. She shifts, feeling vague surprise that for all her desperate longing, she can want this man very much. And then she's unable to think of anything at all. She wakes up, gazing at two sets of dark eyelashes. What very dark eyelashes, she thinks, in the few seconds before consciousness properly seeps in. John's are a caramel colour. He has one white lash towards the outer edge of his left eye, which she is pretty sure no one but her has ever noticed. Birds are singing. A car is revving insistently outside. There is an arm across her naked hip. It's surprisingly heavy, and when she shifts, a hand tightens momentarily on her bottom, as if reflexively unwilling to let her go. She stares at the eyelashes, remembering the events of the previous evening. She and Rory on the floor in front of her sofa. Him fetching the duvet when he noticed she was cold. His hair rich and soft in her hands, his body surprisingly broad above hers. Her bed, his head disappearing under the duvet. She feels a vague thrill of knowledge, and cannot yet quite determine how she feels about this. John. A text message. Coffee, she thinks,
grasping for safety. Coffee and croissants. She eases herself out of his hold, her eyes still fixed on his sleeping face. She lifts his arm, lays it gently on the sheet. He wakes, and she freezes. She sees her own confusion momentarily mirrored in his eyes.
"Hey,"
he says, his voice hoarse with lack of sleep. "What time have they finally slept? 4? 5? She remembers them giggling because it was growing light outside. He rubs his face, shifts heavily onto one elbow. His hair is sticking up at one side, his chin shadowed and rough.
"What time is it?"
"Almost 9. I'm going to nip out for some proper coffee." She backs to the door, conscious of her nakedness in the too bright morning.
"You sure?" he calls as she disappears. "You don't want me to go?"
"No, no." She's hopping into the jeans she discovers outside the living room door. "I'm fine."
"Black for me, please."
She hears him sink back against the pillows, muttering something about his head. Her knickers are half under the DVD player. She picks them up hastily, stuffs them into a pocket. She hauls a T-shirt over her head, wraps herself in her jacket, and without pausing to see what she looks like, heads down the stairs. She walks briskly towards the local coffee shop, already dialing a number into her mobile phone. "Wake up. Pick up the phone." By now, she's standing in the queue. Nikki picks up on the third ring.
"Ellie?"
"Oh, God, Nikki, I've done something awful." She lowers her voice, shielding it from the family who have walked in behind her. The father is silent, the mother trying to shepherd 2 small children to a table. Their pale, shadowed faces speak of a night of lost sleep.
"Hang on, I'm at the gym. Let me take this outside."
"The gym? At 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning?" She hears Nikki's voice against the traffic of some distant street.
"Awful as in what? Murder? Rape of a minor?
You didn't call up Thingy's wife and tell her you were his mistress?"
"I slept with that bloke from work." A brief pause. She looks up to find the barista staring at her, eyebrows raised. She places her hand over her phone.
"Oh, 2 tall Americanos, please. 1 with milk and croissants. 3.
"Library man?"
"Yes. He turned up last night and I was drunk and feeling really crap and he read out one of those love letters and... oh, I don't know."
"So?"
"So I slept with someone else."
"Was it awful?"
Rory's eyes crinkled with amusement, his head bent over her breasts. Kisses. Endless, endless kisses.
"No, it was
quite good.
Really good."
"And your problem is?"
"I'm meant to be sleeping with John."
The barista girl is exchanging looks with exhausted father. She realizes they're both silently agog.
£6.63,
the girl says with a small smile. She reaches into her pocket for change and finds herself holding out last night's knickers. Exhausted father coughs, or it might have been a splutter of laughter. She apologizes, her face burning, hands over the money and moves to the end of the counter, waiting for her coffee with her head down.
"Nikki!"
"Oh, for God's sake, Ellie, you've been sleeping with a married man who's almost definitely still sleeping with his wife. He makes you no promises, hardly takes you anywhere, isn't planning on leaving her.
You don't know that."
"I do know that. I'm sorry, sweetie, but I put my horrid, too small, expensively mortgaged house on it. And if you're telling me you've just had great sex with a nice bloke who's single and likes you, and seems to want to spend time with you, I'm not going to start begging for Prozac. Okay?"
"Okay,"
she says quietly. "Now, go back to your flat, wake him up and have mad hot monkey sex with him, then meet me and Corinne tomorrow morning at the cafe and tell us everything." She smiles. How nice to celebrate being with someone, instead of having perpetually to justify them. She thinks of Rory lying in her bed. Rory of the very long eyelashes and soft kisses. Would it be so very bad to spend the morning with him? She picks up the coffee and walks back to her flat, surprised by how quickly her legs are working.
"Don't move!" she calls, as she comes up the stairs, kicking off her shoes. "I'm bringing you breakfast in bed."
She dumps the coffee on the floor outside the bathroom and dives in, wipes the mascara from under her eyes, and splashes her face with cold water, then spritzes herself with perfume. As an afterthought, she flips the lid off the toothpaste and bites off a pea-sized lump, swilling it around her mouth.
This is so you can no longer think of me as a heartless, selfish abuser of men, and also so you owe me coffee at work. I will, of course, return to my heartless, self-centered self tomorrow.
She leaves the bathroom, stoops to pick up the coffee, and smiling steps into her bedroom. The bed is empty, the duvet turned back. He can't be in the bathroom, she's just been in there.
Rory?
She says into the silence.
Here.
His voice comes from the living room. She pads down the hall.
You were meant to stay in bed.
She admonishes him. It's hardly breakfast in bed if you... He's standing in the centre of the room, pulling on his jacket. He's dressed, shoes on, hair no longer sticking up. She stops in the doorway. He doesn't look at her.
What are you doing?
She holds out the coffee.
I thought we were going to have breakfast.
Yes. Well, I think I'd better go.
She feels something cold creeping across her. Something's wrong here.
Why?
She says, trying to smile. I've hardly been gone 15 minutes. Do you really have an appointment at 9:20 on a Sunday morning? He stares at his feet, apparently checking in his pockets for his keys. He finds them and turns them over in his hand. When he finally looks up at her, his face is blank.
You had a phone call when you were out. He left a message. I didn't mean to eavesdrop, but it's pretty hard not to in a small flat.
Ellie feels something cold and hard settle in the pit of her stomach.
Rory, I...
He holds up a hand.
I told you once I didn't do complicated. That would, include sleeping with someone who's sleeping with someone else.
He steps past her, ignoring the coffee she's holding.
I'll see you around, Ellie.
She hears his footsteps fading down the stairs. He doesn't slam the door, but there's an uncomfortable air of finality in the way it closes. She feels numb. She places the coffee carefully on the table, and then, after a minute, steps over to the answer phone and depresses play. John's voice, low and mellifluous, fills the room.
Ellie, I can't talk for long. Just wanted to check you're okay. Not sure what you meant last night. I miss you too. I miss us. But look, please don't text. It's...
A short sigh.
Look, I'll message you as soon as we... As soon as I get home.
The sound of the receiver clicking down. Ellie lets his words reverberate in the silent flat, then sinks onto the sofa and remains perfectly still, while the coffee grows cold beside her. Dear Mr. B, Re 48 T Avenue. To reiterate, I understand the house purchase will now be in your name only and will not send any further correspondence to be signed to your existing address until you return on the 14th. Letter opened in error by female. Chapter 22. For the attention of Philip O'Hare, philipohare@thetimes.co.uk, from Ellie Howarth, elliehowarth@thenation.co.uk. Excuse me for contacting you like this, but I'm hoping that as a fellow journalist you will understand. I'm trying to trace an Anthony O'Hare, who I guess will be the same age as your father, and in a Times column of last May, you happened to mention that you had a father of the same name. This Anthony O'Hare would have spent some time in London during the early 1960s, and a lot of time abroad, especially in Central Africa, where he may have died. I know very little about him other than he had a son with the same name as you. If you are he, or know what became of him, would you please email me? There is a mutual acquaintance who knew him many years ago, and would dearly like to find out what became of him. I appreciate this is a long shot, as it is not an uncommon name, but I need all the help I can get. All best, Ellie Howarth. The new building is set in a part of the city Ellie has not seen since it was a random collection of shabby warehouses strung together with unlovely takeaway shops she would have starved rather than eaten from. Everything that was in that square mile has been razed, swept away, the congested streets replaced with vast, immaculately clad squares, metal bollards, the odd, gleaming office block, many still bearing the scaffold calls of their nations. They're there for an organised tour, to familiarise themselves with their new desks, the new computers and telephone systems, before Monday's final move. Ellie follows the features party through the various departments, while the young man with a clipboard and a badge marked Transfer Coordinator tells them about production areas, information hubs, and lavatories. As each new space is explained to them, Ellie watches the varying responses of her team, the excitement of some of the younger ones, who like the sleek, modernistic lines of the office. Melissa, who has clearly been there several times before, interjects occasionally with information she feels the man has left out. "There's nowhere to hide," jokes Rupert, as he surveys the vast, clutter-free space. She can hear the ring of truth in it. Melissa's office, on the southeastern corner, is entirely glass, and overlooks a whole features hub. Nobody else in the department has their own office, a decision that has apparently rankled with several of her colleagues. "And this is where you'll be sitting. All the writers are on one desk, a huge oval shape, the centre spewing wires that lead umbilically to a series of flat-screened computers." "Who's where?" says one of the columnists. Melissa consults her list. "I've been working on this. Some of it's still fluid, but Rupert, you're here. Ariana, there. Tim, by the chair, there. Edwina." She points at a space. It reminds Ellie of netball at school. The relief when one was picked from the throng and allotted to one team or the other. Except nearly all of the seats are taken and she is still standing. Melissa, she ventures, "where am I supposed to be sitting?" Melissa glances at another desk. "A few people have to hot desk. It doesn't make sense for everyone to be allocated a workstation full-time." She doesn't look at Ellie as she speaks. Ellie feels her toes clenching in her shoes. "Are you saying I don't get my own desk area?" "No, I'm saying some people will share a workstation." "But I'm in every day. I don't understand how that'll work." She should take Melissa to one side. Ask her in private why Ariana, who has been there barely a month, should get a desk over her. She should expel the slight anguish from her voice. She should shut up. "I don't understand why I'm the only feature writer not to..." "As I said, Ellie, things are very fluid still. There'll always be a seat for you to work from." "Right, let's go on to news. They'll be moving, of course, on the same day that we do." And the conversation is closed. Ellie sees that her stock has fallen far lower than even she had thought. She catches Ariana's eye, sees the new girl look away quickly, and pretends to check her phone for more non-existent messages. The library is no longer below ground. The new Information Resource Centre is two floors up, set in an atrium around a collection of oversized and suspiciously exotic potted plants. There is an island in the middle, behind which she recognises the grumpy chief librarian, who is talking quietly with a much younger man. She stares at the shelves, which are neatly divided into digital and hard copy areas. All the signage in the new offices is in lower case, which, she suspects, has given the chief sub-editor an ulcer. It couldn't be more different from the dusty confines of the old archive, with its musty newspaper smell and blind corners. And she feels suddenly nostalgic. She's not entirely sure why she has come here, except that she feels a magnetic pull to Rory. Perhaps to find out if she's at least partly forgiven, or to talk to him about Melissa's desk decision. He is, she realises, one of the few people she can discuss this with. The librarian spots her. "Sorry," she says, holding up a hand, "just looking around."
"If you want Rory," he says, "he's at the old building."
His voice is not unfriendly. "Thank you," she says, trying to convey something of an apology. It seems important not to alienate anybody else. "It looks great. You've done an amazing job.
Nearly finished, he says,
and smiles. He looks younger when he smiles, less careworn. In his face she can see something she has never noticed before. Relief, but also kindness. How wrong you can get people, she thinks.
Can I help you with anything?
No, I... He smiles again.
Like I said, he's at the old building.
Thank you, I'll leave you to it. I can see you're busy. She walks to a table, picks up a photocopied guide to using the library, and folding it carefully, puts it into her bag as she leaves. She sits at her soon-to-be-defunct desk all afternoon, typing Anthony O'Hare's name repeatedly into a search engine. She has done this numerous times, and each time is astonished by the sheer number of Anthony O'Hares that exist, or have existed, in the world. There are teenage Anthony O'Hares on networking sites, long-dead Anthony O'Hares buried in Pennsylvanian graveyards, their lives pored over by amateur genealogists. One is a physicist working in South Africa, another a self-published writer of fantasy fiction, a third the victim of an attack in a pub in Swansea. She pores over each man, checking age, identity, just in case. Her phone chimes, which tells her of a message. She sees John's name and confusingly feels fleeting disappointment that it isn't Rory.
Meeting.
Melissa's secretary is standing at her desk.
Sorry couldn't talk much other night. Just wanted you to know I am missing you. Can't wait to see you. J. Kiss.
Yes, sorry, she says. The secretary is still beside her. Sorry, just coming. She reads it again, picking apart each sentence, just to make sure that, for once, she's not pitching a mountain of unspoken meaning onto a molehill. But there it is. Just wanted you to know I am missing you. She gathers up her papers, and cheeks aflame, enters the office just in front of Rupert. It's important not to be the last in. She doesn't want to be the only writer without a seat in Melissa's office as well as outside it. She sits in silence while the following day's features are dissected, their progress considered. The humiliations of that morning have receded. Even Ariana's having bagged an interview with a notoriously reclusive actress doesn't faze her. Her mind hums with the words that have fallen unexpectedly into her lap. Just wanted you to know I am missing you. What does this mean? She hardly dares hope that what she has wished for may have come true. The sun-tanned wife in a bikini has effectively vanished. The phantom freckled hand with its massaging fingers is now replaced by knuckles, whitened with frustration. She now pictures John and his wife arguing their way through a holiday they have privately billed as a last-ditch attempt to save their marriage. She sees him exhausted, furious, secretly pleased to get her message even as he has to warn her against sending another. Don't get your hopes up, she warns herself. This might be a little Philip. Everyone's sick of their partner by the end of a holiday. Perhaps he just wants to ensure he still has her loyalty. But even as she counsels herself, she knows which version she wants to believe. And Ellie, the love letters story. Oh, Christ. She shuffles the papers on her lap, adopts a confident tone. Well, I've got a lot more information. I met the woman. There's definitely enough for a story.
Good.
Melissa's eyebrows lift elegantly, as if she surprised her. But, Ellie swallows, I'm not sure how much we should use. It does seem a bit sensitive.
Are they both alive?
No, he's dead, or she believes he is.
Then change the woman's name. I don't see the problem. You're using letters that she'd presumably forgotten.
Oh, I don't think she had. Ellie tries to pick her words carefully. In fact, she seems to remember an awful lot about them. I was thinking it would be better if I used them as a peg to examine the language of love. You know, how love letters have changed over the years.
Without including the actual letters?
Yes. As she answers, Ellie feels hugely relieved. She doesn't want Jennifer's letters made public. She sees her now, perched on her sofa, her face alive as she tells the story she has kept to herself for decades. She doesn't want to add to her sense of loss. I mean, maybe I could find some other examples.
By Tuesday. Well, there must be books. Compilations. You want us to publish already published material?
The room has fallen silent around them. It is as if she and Melissa Buckingham exist in a toxic bubble. She is conscious that nothing she does will satisfy this woman any more.
You've been working on this for the time it takes most writers to knock out 3 2,000-word features.
Melissa taps the end of her pen on her desk.
Just write the piece, Ellie.
Her voice is icily weary.
Just write it up, keep it anonymous, and your contact will probably never know whose letters you're discussing. And I'm assuming, given the sheer amount of time you've now spent on this, that it's going to be something extraordinary.
Her smile, bestowed on the rest of the room, is glittering.
Right, let's move on. I haven't had a list from Health. Has anyone got one?
She sees him as she's leaving the building. He shares a joke with Ronald, the security guard, treads lightly down the steps and walks away. It's raining, and he carries a small rucksack on his back, his head down against the cold.
Hey!
She jogs until she's beside him. He glances at her.
Hey,
he says neutrally. He's headed for the tube station and doesn't slow his pace as he reaches the steps down into it.
I wondered, do you fancy a quick drink?
I'm busy.
Where are you off to?
She has to lift her voice to be heard against the thunderous noise of feet, the Victorian acoustics of the underground system.
The new building.
They're surrounded by commuters. Her feet are almost lifting off the ground as she's borne down the stairs among the sea of people.
Wow, that must be some overtime.
No, just helping the boss with a few final things so that he doesn't wear himself out completely.
I saw him today.
When Rory doesn't reply, she adds,
he was nice to me.
Yeah, well, he's a nice man.
She manages to walk alongside him until they reach the ticket barrier. He steps to one side to allow others to pass through.
Silly, really, she says. You pass people every day without having a clue.
Look, Ellie, what do you want?
She bites her lip. Around them, the commuters separate like water, earphones on, some tutting audibly at the human obstacles in their path. She rubs at her hair, which is now damp.
I just wanted to say I'm sorry about the other morning.
It's cool.
No, it's not. But it's... Look, what happened? It's nothing to do with you, and I really like you. It's just this is something that...
You know what? I'm not interested.
It's fine, Ellie. Let's leave it at that.
He goes through the ticket barrier. She follows. She caught a glimpse of his expression before he turned, and it was horrible. She feels horrible. She positions herself behind him on the escalator. Little pearls of water are dotted across his grey scarf, and she fights the urge to sweep them off.
Rory, I'm really sorry.
He's staring at his shoes. He glances at her. His eyes cold.
Married, huh?
What?
Your friend. It was pretty obvious from what he said.
Don't look at me like that.
Like what?
I didn't mean to fall in love.
He lets out a short, unpleasant laugh. They've reached the bottom of the escalator. He picks up his pace, and she's forced to run a little to keep up. The tunnel smells of stale air and burnt rubber.
I didn't!
Rubbish! You make a choice. Everyone makes a choice.
So you've never been transported by something, never felt that pull?
He faces her.
Of course I have. But if acting on it meant I was going to hurt someone else, I took a step back.
Her face flames.
Well, aren't you wonderful?
No. But you're hardly a victim of circumstance. Presumably you knew he was married and chose to go along with it anyway. You had the choice to say no.
It didn't feel like that.
His voice lifts sarcastically.
It was bigger than both of us. I think you've been more affected by those love letters than you think.
Oh, well, good for you, Mr. Practical. Bully for you that you can turn your emotions on and off like taps. Yes, I let myself fall into it, okay? Immoral? Yes. Ill-advised? Well, judging by your response, obviously. But I felt something magical for a bit and don't worry, I've been paying for it ever since.
But you're not the only one, are you? Every act has a consequence, Ellie. In my view, the world divides into people who can see that and make a decision accordingly, and those who just go for what feels good at the time.
Oh, Christ! Have you any idea how bloody pompous you sound?
She's shouting now, barely conscious of the curious commuters who file past, fed into the tunnels of the district and circle lines.
Yes. And no one in your world is allowed to make a mistake.
Once, he says, you can make a mistake once.
He stares off into the distance, his jaw set, as if working out how much to say. Then he turns to face her.
I was on the other side, okay, Ellie. I loved someone who found someone else that she couldn't resist. Something that was bigger than both of them. Until, of course, he dumped her. And I let her back into my life, and she burnt me a second time. So, yes, I do have an opinion on it.
She's rooted to the spot. There's a rush of noise, a blast of hot, disturbed air as a train approaches. Passengers surge forward.
You know something, he says, his voice lifting over the din. I'm not judging you for falling in love with this man. Who knows, perhaps he's the love of your life. Perhaps his wife really would be better off without him. Perhaps the two of you really were meant to be.
But you could have said no to me. Suddenly, she sees something unexpected. Something raw and exposed in his face.
That's what I'm having trouble getting my head round. You could have said no to me. That would have been the right thing to do.
He hops lightly into the packed carriage, just as the doors close. It pulls away with a deafening whine. She watches his departing back in the illuminated window until it disappears. The right thing for who?
Hey, babe. Thought of you all weekend. How is uni? Barry says all birds who go to uni eventually find someone else. But I told him he was talking out of his backside. He's just jealous. He went out with that girl from the estate agents on Tuesday, and she blew him out after the main course. Just said she was going to the ladies, and went. He said he sat there 20 minutes before he realised. We were all killing ourselves down at the Feathers. Wish you were here, babe. Nights seem long without you. Write to me soon. Clive. Kiss, kiss.
Ellie sits in the middle of her bed, a dusty cardboard box on her lap. The correspondence of her teenage years spread out around her. She is in bed at 9:30 p.m., trying desperately to think of some way of salvaging the love letters feature for Melissa, without exposing Jennifer to public view. She thinks of Clive, her first love, a tree surgeon's son who had gone to the same secondary school. They'd agonized over whether she should go to university, sworn that it wouldn't affect their relationship. They lasted about 3 months after she went to Bristol. She remembers how the appearance of his battered mini in the car park outside her halls of residence morphed frighteningly swiftly from being glorious, a signal for her to spray on perfume and belt down the corridor, to a sinking feeling of dismay, when she knew she no longer felt anything for him, except a sensation of being pulled back into a life she no longer wanted. Dear Clive, I've spent much of the night trying to work out how to do this in a way that is going to cause each of us as little pain as possible. But there is no easy way to. Dear Clive, this is a really difficult letter to write, but I have to come out and say that I... Dear Clive, I'm really sorry, but I don't want you to come down anymore.